Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Like an all-female Last Supper, 13 women gathered for a meal around a long, narrow table in an upstairs room over the Fumbly Cafe in the centre of Old Dublin. Each of us was invited to make a short toast over the course of the evening to our grandmothers. Granny Murphy, my maternal grandmother, was one of 13 children and progressed through secondary school and a university degree, all on scholarships. She married a young academic who, 6 months after they married, nearly died from TB. He survived, but Granny found herself living with an invalid for the rest of her married life. While teaching Irish in UCD, she established a women's conference of the St. Vincent de Paul Society, whose members would visit the Dublin tenements of the time to establish for themselves what help and supports were needed in those impoverished households. This visiting work was usually done only by men. Family lore has it that the Archbishop of Dublin, John Charles McQuaid, threatened to excommunicate Granny if she persisted in having the women of her conference visit the tenements. She ignored his threats and was never excommunicated. On my father's side, Cuckoo Gran, who would warble, "Cuckoo," flicking back her hands to reveal her eyes as she smiled down at me in my carry cot, had started life motherless, her mother having died giving birth to her. Her father also died when she was only 5. So she and her sister were sent as boarders to an Ursuline convent in Essex. Gran had much for which to thank England. Kindness, friends, an education, a holiday home with a welcoming family. So perhaps she can be forgiven for constantly referring right up to her death in 1981 to our Queen, as well as her habit of compulsively checking the weather reports in the Daily Telegraph to establish whether or not she should bring an umbrella on a trip to the shops in Dunleary. That night in the Fumbly Cafe, a light shone on stories of survival, persistence, subversive assertiveness in a male-dominated era, ingenuity and idiosyncrasy. Above all, every story glowed with the fierce love of family and the ideals and passions that sustained and energised these women. Leah Dawn's fervently Republican mammo provided safe haven for IRA men on the run in a secret room in her mother's house during the 1930s. Decades later, she would embarrass her grandchildren by insisting on addressing every shopkeeper she encountered in Irish, regardless of whether they spoke the language or not. The same beautiful brown eyes of a woman whose self-portrait was included in the montage of grandmother images we had supplied for the evening looked out at us from the face of her granddaughter, who recounted how her artist grandmother had taken to the bed in later years, perhaps a self-preservation response in a society with limited empathy for a woman of intense sensitivity and creative talent. A Donegal granny, finding herself perilously short of whisky one afternoon in the mid-1960s, instructed her granddaughter to drive her to the nearest town to buy some. "But I don't know how to drive, Granny." "And neither do you," protested Pat, who was 17 at the time. "No bother, daughter. Haven't I seen the men do it often enough? I'll tell you what to do." And they managed just fine. Young Pat parked the car carefully at Granny's direction, back in exactly the same spot from which they'd taken it. She learned a useful lesson that day in how far a little daring and discretion can take you. Jean's grandmother, Sybil, was a qualified doctor who, after being widowed at the age of 57, joined the religious order of the Medical Missionaries of Mary. Having renounced her comfortable home and lifestyle, she found herself on her knees, scrubbing the floor tiles of the convent toilets with a toothbrush. Later, as a missionary doctor, she performed emergency surgery in bush clinics in Tanzania. She completed her first operation successfully, relying, she said later, on a medical textbook and the power of prayer. Razan, originally from Syria, described long afternoons when she was a child, spent tending the olive trees with her grandmother, Saada. Afterwards, Saada would sit silently on a hilltop, watching the sun go down, while her little granddaughter danced and shuffled around her. "Granny, what are you doing?" she'd say. "I want to go." "Hush, child," her grandmother would reply. "I am meditating. I am listening to nature." Each granddaughter there reflected on what it was we had received from our grandmothers that formed part of the women we ourselves had become. I came to see how I'd inherited my maternal grandmother's disdain for authority figures, and how I'd blossomed in the warmth of the sheer delight in my existence that shone on me from Cuckoo Gran. Every grandmother remembered that night had her oddities, her inconsistencies, and her flaws. In toasting our grandmothers, we learned the importance not only of celebrating the strengths, but also of accepting and forgiving the flaws of our wonderful grandmothers, of ourselves, our sisters, our mothers, and each other.
I've been thinking a lot about Marianne Finucane since her death. I live 3,000 miles away in New York, and I feel a void. When I participated in her newspaper panel, I loved to watch her flip through her notes and declare, "And a very good morning to you." Her voice was soothing, but carried effortless authority. The radio, if you listen carefully enough, doesn't lie. The first time I took my seat in Marianne's studio, I thought, "I've arrived." I was there to discuss very important issues of national interest, dinner party etiquette. I took a deep breath and made sure to enjoy and appreciate the moment. Over the years, I'd be invited back to the program regularly to talk about everything from online dating to the banking crisis, and later, marriage equality. The trajectory of my career seemed to play out in her studio, and it continued all the way to New York. Even before the banking crisis, I was strapped for cash. Marianne liked that I still threw a tablecloth over a wallpaper pasting table for dinner guests. My culinary repertoire consisted of one dish, pasta surprise. It has feta, tomatoes, spinach, onions, secret spices, that is, whatever is lying around, and lashings of garlic. As one friend noted 20 years after I first served it, "The only surprise is that you're still making it." On another show in the weeks before Christmas, I told Marianne that I ruled my dinner parties with an iron fist. She peered at me over her glasses with a quizzical, amused look. Of course, I added, being a good guest is just as critical as being a good host, but the host must set the tone. On that particular Sunday morning, her producer fielded a call from a disgruntled host who wanted to out me as having cancelled on his dinner party at the last minute. I was about to get roasted right there, live on RTE Radio 1. Luckily for me, her producer didn't put him through. It wasn't the first time a female journalist had saved my bacon. 15 years ago, I wrote a piece for the Sunday Tribune about homophobia in Irish life. On the TV, on the streets, in the classrooms. It was the first time I'd written about this subject. This time, I put my own story out there. I felt exposed. My phone rang that Sunday morning. It was Anne Farrell, producer for Marianne Finucane. She put me through live to that week's newspaper panel. We wouldn't be talking about dinner party etiquette today. On that day, I found my voice. Years before, the late Christina Murphy fished my CV out of a pile and offered me an internship at the Irish Times a couple of months before I finished my journalism postgrad in Galway. I don't know what direction my career or my life would have taken without that opportunity. It would turn into a pattern. Caroline Walsh was features editor at the Irish Times during that summer internship. One day she spotted a lost 21-year-old kid sitting forlornly in the canteen on Delir Street. She asked me to write a feature about polo. "Isn't it great now we have Quentin writing that story?" Caroline said to her assistant. I knew that she said it within earshot so I would feel like I had something of value to contribute. Like the magic porridge pot, small acts of kindness keep on giving. Caroline too is gone, and that was nearly 30 years ago, but it means as much to me today. Mary Cummins sat behind me that summer. She had copper hair, blue eyeshadow, and cloaks galore. My anxious paper shuffling attracted her attention. She swiveled around in her chair and offered to go through an article I had written about a dispute involving nuns selling their land. "We covered this story last year," she said. "Check the clippings." In my current job in New York, I hire our summer intern. It is the most important thing I do all year. Mary Holland, a political reporter who, like her namesake Mary Cummins, died far too young, walked into the Irish Times office one day that summer and pinned a rainbow flag on my lapel. She was a smart, for me intimidating, and no-nonsense woman with a demeanour of warm steel who broke stories about secret peace contact between the British government and the IRA. I looked down at my lapel and back at Mary. It was the 24th of June, 1993, the day Ireland officially passed legislation that finally decriminalised homosexuality. I didn't feel out of place that day. I felt seen. Nobody else noticed what she did. It took a moment, and it was done. But she may as well have wrapped a warm blanket around me. A decade later, women journalists still had my back. At the Sunday Tribune Christmas party at McGrattan's Bar and Restaurant in Dublin, Nuala O'Fuaillon worried about me walking home alone in my flashy fur coat. "You might get beaten up," she said. I gave it serious thought. After all, I was a pint-sized, fur-clad social columnist who had dodged trouble, perhaps one too many times. Would tonight be the night I ended up in the gutter? I wore the coat home, but I kept my eyes peeled. Then, as now, such vigilance goes with the territory. I've had 4 full-time writing jobs in my life, 2 in London, 1 in Dublin, and 1 in New York. In all of them, without exception, I was hired by women. Christina Murphy, Caroline Walsh, Mary Cummins, Mary Holland, that generation of feminists paved the way for today's crop. I wish they were still with us to see so many things they fought for coming into being. And Marion? She never quite showed her hand on the social and political issues of the day. Perhaps staying above the fray enhanced her status as one of the most celebrated broadcasters of her generation. She shone a light on stories that might otherwise have gone ignored. She and her sisters-in-arms helped lay the foundations for modern Ireland. But they all made sure to leave the ladder behind for those who came after them.
A March morning back in the early 80s, I am on my way to school in Miskolc, the second largest city of then communist Hungary. There is a stretch in the days. Snowdrops, crocuses and tulips have broken through the snowy ground. Once inside the school building, I approach the classroom. Some of my classmates, just the girls, stand outside the door engaging in excited chatter. "We locked out. The boys are in there." Then it hits me. It is March the 8th, International Women's Day. On this one day of the year, we girls would notice extra attention from the boys. And I don't mean the "I pull your ponytail and run away before you can catch me" kind of attention. We felt special. Eventually, one of the boys in the class, with a proud smile on his face, would open the door to let us into the classroom. Each girl's desk would be decorated with snowdrops, tied in a neat little bunch, and a small bar of chocolate beside it. Same number of flowers, same brand of chocolate for each of us. Even the girls that were not extremely popular with the boys on the other days of the year would feel proud and comfortable with their female identity on this day. We didn't know that this type of celebration of girls and women was just the tail end of a once much more significant ideological programming of women's role in the communist society. The history of International Women's Day reaches back to March the 8th, 1857, when 40,000 women workers in New York went on strike to demand equal pay and a reduction of their working hours. In 1910, March the 8th, the opening day of the International Socialist Conference in Copenhagen, was dedicated to national women's movements throughout the world. However, it wasn't until Soviet women walked onto the streets to demonstrate for bread and peace in 1917 that Soviet leaders started to look upon women as a force to be utilized. When Hungary came under Soviet rule after World War II, our landscape of national and religious holidays went through profound transformation. Some were done away with, others were elevated to a higher level of importance if they promoted the regime. Mother's Day was pushed into the background, whereas International Women's Day became compulsory to observe. The economy needed more working hands, not more mouths to feed. In post-war Hungary, there was a shortage of able-bodied men, so women played a significant role in rebuilding the country. Anyway, who would want to spend their life tending to the family hearth when they could be out plowing the fields of the cooperative from morning till evening? According to Women's Day posters from the 40s, the happiest women on earth were the muscular ones driving huge tractors in muddy fields, strong, determined, and proud to contribute to their country's economic growth. Daintiness and grace were things of the past. Marilyn Monroe would have been hard done by in the communist society. And so, based on Soviet propaganda, a strange kind of emancipation started to take root in society. Now, men and women had equal rights. Well, equal rights to work in any case. Married or single, women were expected to enter the workforce. And those female factory workers, miners, construction workers, or bus drivers smiling on the black and white covers of women's magazines of the time were role models. Male leaders of the regime would graciously overlook the fact that the same women would still usually be the ones to look after the household when they got home from their day job. The idea of a husband offering a helping hand with home chores didn't occur to many. There was no public discourse on the huge discrepancies between men's and women's salaries either. In the 50s and 60s, as the country was getting back on its feet, female communist role models changed. More and more positions were opening up to women, especially if they were not well paid enough for men. Now, teachers, nurses, and office workers would smile from the covers of national newspapers and magazines on March the 8th. At workplaces, it was the responsibility of the Socialist Brigade to organize some form of celebration on the day. Speeches were given, and workers' medals of excellency were awarded in praise of working women. Company gatherings were held in canteens, where men would give a tulip and serve food to their female colleagues on International Women's Day. And if the women were lucky, it wouldn't always be they who had to clean up after the event because the tired men had fled the scene. As communism began to phase out in the 80s, workers' medals and socialist brigade gatherings were forgotten. International Women's Day, as I remember it from my school days, was a day to honor women for their true worth. Men continued to give flowers to their female co-workers and family members, more enthusiastically than ever. Younger generations followed suit. So I think I can safely say that the snowdrops and the chocolate bars that I and other girls were given in the 80s were being offered with genuine warmth, appreciation, and respect.
Selfies. I look in the mirror and my mother looks back. The fall of the nose, brown eyes. For her too, there's a grandmother lurking. Those tiny feet and hands, layers of taffeta and lace. When she was no age, a cheetah chased her into a tent in India, while her tipsy father paraded on his dancing horse. And then there's the strict demeanour of a Sunday, with the blinds drawn halfway down. A newspaper rustles in the front room, and a tram clatters down the light-filled street to the worrying tremor of sash windows. And here they are, in the one place. Suitcases at their feet. Departure for London, Toronto, Nottingham. Between wars and in the war, and later on, who knows where we'll be next? Just the recollected house that doesn't exist anymore, and them all seated in their best, in a perfect silence they cannot forget.
At the tail end of the 1960s, lolling in closeted captivity in a convent boarding school, I was oblivious to the political movements of the time. As riotous revolutionaries thrashed out world-changing ideas, I wrote love poems in the back of my longman's Latin grammar while being educated in the essentials of life, like how to eat with my mouth closed and whether to bow or genuflect when kissing the bishop's ring. Little had changed in Irish boarding schools since Baba and Kate bolted out of Edna O'Brien's Country Girls. Released in 1970 and raw as a peeled egg, I walked into my future with my good leaving cert, perfect table manners, and an insatiable wedding lust. I'd get one of those jobs reserved for women in the lower levels of the civil service, I thought, and wait for the one. Or perhaps I'd go to university and then get one of those jobs reserved for women in the lower levels. As Nora Ephron put it, women weren't meant to have futures. Women were meant to marry them. With writers like Simone de Beauvoir and Betty Friedan, as rare as female jurors in 1970s Ireland, for reading material we relied a lot on the daily newspapers. One evening, to while away the hours of please God, let him call me. I opened the Irish Press and was jolted out of my reverie by the image of Mary Kenny sprawled across the woman's page, poster of Shea in the background, floppy hat, catsuit, legs outstretched, painted lips smirking at the camera with a careless sang-froid. Mary Kenny didn't waste ink on home remedies for pimples or how to be inventive with turnips. She banged out paragraphs that soared like cannonballs against wrongs suffered by women. With gunfire precision, she totted up pots scoured, shirts ironed, potatoes peeled, and calculated that the brain power used wouldn't fill a gin glass. Generations of young women, she wrote, who might have prevented wars or cured cancer, had been squandered into making up marmalade recipes. Blank as new blotting paper, I soaked it all up. Each morning, I waited for the ripping reads penned by Mary and her peers in the other dailies, exposing discrimination, shame and abuse. Through their first-person dramas, we came to know them, each other and ourselves. A sisterhood was born. Women were, it seemed, a newly discovered species, and soon shops and buses buzzed with talk of women's issues. Mary Kenny and others from the newly formed Irish Women's Liberation Movement presented their case on The Late Late Show. We, who had been reading the women's pages, now witnessed the words made flesh. They didn't disappoint. They blew cigarette smoke into Gabo's face as they told him about sex, contraception, and a woman's right to control her own body. You felt sure he was reddening, though you were watching in black and white. I was terrified that my mother would switch it off. But then Garrett Fitzgerald ran into the studio, and I'm pretty sure he was still in his slippers. Incensed by something Mary had said about legislators, he had dashed from his fireside. It was an unfortunate mistake. With sage-like demeanour, he began to mansplain how women should climb the greasy pole, only to be cut back to monosyllables by Nell McCafferty's sardonic wit. The audience went wild. Oliver J. Flanagan, TD, spoke of godless people introducing the laws of the jungle. Contraception was in the headlines. Shops and buses hummed with stories of ovaries and wombs and billings, and priests, who knew all about such things, sprinted to their pulpits to read a pastoral letter from Archbishop McQuaid. Mary Kenny and others walked out of church and all the way to the Archbishop's residence, and not to genuflect or kiss his ring. His Lordship, regally remote in his palace, had his lovely Sunday ruined, ripped out like a page from his ecclesiastical calendar. In May 1971, the most famous action of all, the contraceptive train to Belfast and back, became the climax of the women's campaign. Some of them proudly waved their illegal booty about as they declared their contraband to mortified customs officers at Connolly Station. A priest likened being on the train to being on page 3 of The Sun and described contraception as murder by anticipation. Mary Kenny retaliated, saying shocking things in posh English. Mothers worried about their daughter's future, but to us, that future was where the old people lived. It's surprising to remember that the Irish Women's Liberation Movement barely lasted a year. Soon its members moved on to mount other campaigns and Mary Kenny moved to London. But by then, she and her group of daring, visionary feminists had inspired my generation to think, to fight discrimination and to challenge the systems and structures we'd always taken for granted.
Butterfly House. Something is unfurling in this place. Wishes floating softly in the mist. The space between greenery and vivid flowers is as warm as hope. In this moment, I'm unaged, transformed backwards to a spellbound child. Three generations are present, but there are more here. As colours alight gently like souls, fragile breath of lives present and past. We are moved to silence until Willow, the two-year-old, her arms spread out like wings, takes off running after violet-blue angels. I want to follow, not to capture them, but to take flight.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, we heard Grandmothers by Andrea Martin, Lowering the Ladder by Quentin Fottrell, Snowdrops and Chocolates by Bernadette Buda, Selfies, a poem by Gerald Daw, Me and Mary Kenny by Lord McKay, and Butterfly House, a poem by Denise Blake. The music was Songs My Mother Taught Me by Dvorak, played by Joshua Bell on violin. Feet of a Dancer, written by Charlie McGettigan and sung by Maura O'Connell. Ugrosh from Old Hungarian Dances by Ferenc Farkas, played by the Adelphi Saxophone Quartet. Avril 14th by Aphex Twin. And We Are Family by Sister Sledge. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.